it's fairly standard in the way claims would be defined in bills of this nature. But basically, a request or demand for money or property that is made, if the state has provided or will provide a portion of it, and if the state has reimbursed it. It basically, if the state's involved in the process of paying on a claim, then that's the kind of case that we're talking about. Subdivision 3 is a very important provision. It is the liability standard. Mens rea, I guess, would be the analogy in criminal cases. In this particular case, Subdivision 3 provides that the actor that would become liable would only be liable if their act was knowing or knowingly. And that is more specifically defined as having had actual knowledge of the information or acting in deliberate ignorance of the truth or falsity of the information or acting in reckless disregard of that truth or falsity. If a company can be held to know as an organization that false billings are being submitted to the state, or if they deliberately ignored the question of whether the billings were true or false, or if they recklessly disregarded that truth or falsity, then they would be held to a standard of liability. This does not require specific intent to defraud. So they don't have to have had in their mind the specific idea that they're going to set up a scheme of false billing to enrich themselves. But if it's going on and they know about it, and then they are liable to the state. Subdivision 4 defines original source, that would be person who has direct and independent knowledge. And here is an example of an area in which we have made an amendment after having discussions with some of those other parties of interest to this legislation. We inserted "and independent" into this to make sure that that the knowledge of the person who comes forth, becomes a whistleblower, is gained from inside the organization, not from some other external source, such as a news report or something like that. What we want is only for, if this information is wholly contained within the offending organization, and then a person comes forth with that information, that's only when they would be entitled to recover a share of the proceeds. So that's basically the important piece of original source. Person under subdivision 5, that is basically the definition of the organization that would be liable or that was falsely billing, for example. Now, that could be a person, a partnership, a corporation, an association, or other legal entity. Liability provision under Section 2 provides a civil penalty for each act of that's described in the later in clauses 1 through 8. And the civil penalty would be between $5,500 and $11,000 per false or fraudulent claim, plus 3 times the amount of damages sustained because of that act. So there are 2 components to liability. One is the actual damage or the amount of the false billing. Actually 3. That would be the basic piece of it. That could be trebled up to 3 times that amount would be the definition of actual damage. That is, in part, the disincentive to engage in this kind of conduct. If it were only the amount itself and not treble damages, then you would simply be reimbursing the state if you were caught. And there would be no additional cost to you of engaging in the fraudulent activity. And that is also the basis for the other piece, the penalty amount. Between $5,500 and $11,000 per false claim. The important piece of the penalty is also that if it were to turn out that there was not any actual damage, that say the fraud was caught at a stage or did not involve an actual payment, maybe the billings were going in but payment hadn't been made yet, so there hadn't been any financial loss actually to the state, there would still be a financial penalty to the offending person, the corporation, whomever it is, as a consequence for engaging in that conduct. We wouldn't want them to get away with it simply because the act was caught before money went out of the state treasury. So that is the basis for that provision. If you turn then to the second page, you have the list of 1 through 8 of the specific kinds of acts which would be actionable. And I'm not going to run through each one of them individually with you, although I'm happy to talk with you about any of them if you like. I will point out, if you look at number 1, it's probably the broadest one. Knowingly presents to an officer or employee of the state a false or fraudulent claim for payment or approval. The others are basically variations on a theme to get at similar but not identical such activity. I will point out that on lines 2.18 and 1.9, I think the line numbers I'm working off of might have been referring to the House file number. But let me see if I can find the
16 to 18.
We added or used, maybe counsel could.
Ms. Pontius?
There.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if you're referring to clause 7.
The words used were inserted. Let me just say it was a suggestion. One of the lines in here was another suggestion by parties interested in this that we had not included originally, and we made the addition of some language to conform with federal law.
Senator Latz, what was that again? I'm sorry.
Is that number 4?
Unfortunately, the form I have is off of the House file, so maybe I can find the give you the direct reference. In paragraph 4 of section 2, A4, you'll see on line 2.8 it says money, the word money, and then it says used, comma, or. Those words were added to conform with the federal law, but it was also at the suggestion of one of the parties that's been paying attention to the process. I also want to note to you that in paragraph 7, which would be line 2.16, 2.16. If you look on 2.17, which says knowingly fails, we inserted the, as part of the delete everything amendment, we inserted the word knowingly at the suggestion of this other party of interest, particularly to allay fears that we were creating a strict liability statute. We did not intend to do that. We also delete, and on line 2.18 there, we had originally required that a report be submitted within a reasonable time, but in any event within 30 days, and we deleted the 30-day provision so that there'd be a little more flexibility there. as well, at their suggestion. Moving forward then, there are, in paragraph B, there are some additional direction to the reviewing court with regard to the amount of damages that would actually give some adjustment in the treble damages cap to reflect the conduct and cooperation of the target corporation, if you will. So they can help out a lot come forward, be more forthcoming with information and cooperate and things, and then they can as a result they can get credit toward what their liability would be. then those, frankly, those are the guts of the bill. But let me tell you how that it would work procedurally, just briefly. And this is what's contained really in the rest of the bill. A person could choose to bring a private action. They would file it under seal with the state court if it's purely a state claim. If it includes a federal false claims, that claim would have to be filed in federal court. And then that action would remain under seal while the whistleblower notified the Attorney General's Office of Minnesota. The Attorney General's Office would then have the opportunity, if they chose to exercise it, to investigate themselves, and if they felt it appropriate to intervene, basically to take over the case. If they took over the case, then and then the state's resources were expended in investigating and pursuing the case, then the whistleblower's potential recovery is capped between 15 and 25%. If the state were to decline to take over the case and the whistleblower and his or her attorney put forward the investigative resources and everything to pursue the case, then the recovery for the whistleblower would be between 25 and 30%. So they get a little more to recover if, in fact, they're the ones who pursue, ultimately have to pursue the case to resolution. We did make a number of other accommodations, and without going into great detail, I'm just going to tell you that we had extensive discussions with a lot of the other parties that have an interest in this legislation. We had one group that provided 13 proposed amendments to it. Representative Simon, the chief author in the House, and I have been working closely on this, and we accepted 10 of their 13 suggestions. So we've been working hard to try to take into consideration those interests. There was another group that made a number of suggestions. We accepted one of their suggestions as well. I know time is of concern, maybe I'll quit there unless anyone has any particular questions and ask for an opportunity for Mr. Thompson to explain his experience.
Members, questions for Senator Latz on Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Latz. The one thing that occurs to me, probably because I am an attorney and I've is I wonder if there's been given thought to or if there's an intent to include attorneys or because I wonder in the context of talking about insurance claims or injuries if information might be shared with an attorney that would then put that attorney in a position of having to report that attorney's client or potentially having liability under this statute. So I wonder if that was given any thought or consideration at all and if we might want to have an exception there, at least just for past acts.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, if I understand your question, it would be a kind of a situation where, for example, a corporation and their counsel, their own attorneys, and those attorneys became aware of information or conduct within the corporation that might be subject to this bill. Would those attorneys then have an obligation to come forward and disclose that information? Is that your question?
Senator Olson.
Well, Senator Latz, Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I guess, you know, that could be one idea or one scenario, but what I'm thinking of is just, you know, a client who's been in an accident and has made claims or perhaps is pursuing just a situation where the information might have been presented in a way that was knowingly false, and the attorney becomes aware of that. Does the attorney then have an affirmative obligation to, because that person knowingly has knowledge of a false claim that was made?
Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think the answer to that would be twofold. One is, this bill would only apply to claims made to the state of Minnesota, or I suppose its political subdivisions. So in the event of, say, a private auto accident case where there were bills that were made to a private insurance company, that would not be involved. But secondly, this bill does not propose to obligate anyone to come forward with information. It provides an incentive for people to come forward with that information. There's no penalty if they fail to come forward with the information as an individual. So then I think an attorney's obligation with regard to their client would remain unchanged by this bill. They are still subject to the rules of ethics and the professional conduct with regard to knowing and disclosing if their clients are engaging in illegal conduct or activity.
Senator Pearsall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, as the bill is written right before us, who has the burden of proof of deciding what the intent and knowing is? I mean, where is the burden in the whole scheme of things?
Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, Senator Pearsall, as in any civil action, the burden would be upon the plaintiff, the whistleblower, or the state if the state intervened, approving that the corporation, for example, was engaged in the prohibited conduct.
And that would require some kind of evidence or something? I mean, you know, where is that stated in here?
Yes,
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Pearsall, burden of proof is by a preponderance of evidence. I believe it is specifically stated in here. But that is a standard burden of proof in all civil actions, and they would have to come forward with evidence, examples of billings and all that kind of thing to be able to prove the case. Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Pearsall, I believe that's on line 6.20 where the standard proof is articulated. Let's have Mr. Thompson, please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Neil Thompson, and I want to give the committee my perspective on the last 3.5 years of my life as it involved a false claim. I'm a whistleblower, and I spent 3.5 years of my life helping the state of Minnesota and the federal government recover taxpayers' money. I'm the individual that you might have seen on CNN and in the Star and Tribune, along with a friend of mine and colleague, Dan Burance. We turned in Walgreens for defrauding Medicaid. I've been a pharmacist for 31 years, licensed here in the state. I first started working for my father in a neighborhood store. Later, I owned that pharmacy, and later in my career, I went to work for some of the larger chains here in Minnesota. I can confidently tell the committee that even though you have seen large fraud awards on the news, you haven't seen anything yet. We have only seen the tip of the iceberg in healthcare fraud. I believe there's not a pharmacy around that I couldn't work in for 6 months and identify some sort of Medicaid fraud or Medicare care fraud. Fraud by its very nature is covered up. It's hidden. In my case, I was even told by my supervisors when I turned it in, I told 5 different supervisors that this was going on over a 3-year period of time before we filed suit. They basically told me, we handle this at headquarters. These buildings are all pre-adjusted, and I knew they weren't. I had already called the Department of Human Services here in Minnesota to verify that these claims were being overbilled. It takes somebody on the inside. It takes somebody who sees and works with this on a daily basis to be able to have a claim simply for this state to be able to recover. Without that, all the investigative efforts by the state or the police agencies are for naught. They'll never discover this stuff. When I discovered it and explained it to the Attorney General and to the U.S. Attorney, it took 3 meetings with a pharmacy billing expert before they really understood how it was happening. The very basis of our system of laws is voluntary compliance. Every law you pass requires citizens to enforce them. It requires compliance with the law. There's no amount of money in the Treasury here in the state to be able to catch this kind of stuff without the help of a whistleblower or somebody on the inside. You'll never see these frauds. You'll never get the chance to recover this money without having a whistleblower who has the protection of law to help them along. I say protected because you have to understand that being a whistleblower in any of these cases is a career-ending event. I've applied to 4 other pharmacy organizations since I made this public. None of them will even call me back. Maybe it's because I was on the news or something, but And maybe it'll lighten up in the future, but in most cases, this is a career-ending event. I've done a lot of things in my life. I've practiced pharmacy. I went to the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy. I've owned pharmacies. I've worked in lots of different industries. I've been held up 8 times as a pharmacist in armed robberies. I went to law school to try and correct things that I saw in the pharmacy industry. But I can tell you, nothing is as stressful in your life as spending 3.5 years having sued your employer, walking into that employer every day of your life, knowing full well what you did, that you caused the FBI to appear at 12 of your bosses' and supervisors' homes at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night to be interviewed about the wrongdoings of their employer, knowing full well that when they find out, they're going to try and figure out some way to get rid of me, some way to discredit me, and knowing that I may never, ever practice in the profession that I love again. Like I say, I've applied to other places. No one will even talk to me. I'll never be able to practice of pharmacy again, and it's a good, lucrative profession. You know that there's a huge shortage of pharmacists in the country right now, and why wouldn't they even call me back? Because I turned somebody in. This law does many things to eradicate fraud. It tells the state, it gives a message that the state is serious about taking care of fraud. It gives extra compensation to the state, you know, in the form of Medicaid fraud. But the issues about this law are not about this Minnesota share versus federal share and cost to the state versus whistleblower rewards. Minnesota is already incurring the cost. They're already being cheated by Medicaid fraud. What the real issue here is about Minnesota even getting the chance to recover some of that money. Because without whistleblowers and without rewarding them and protecting them, you will never have the chance. So even though you might talk about these percentages and stuff, those, you're not going to have any percentages without people on the inside turning these things in. Thank you very much.
Any questions for the witness? Very good. Let's have the other testifiers come to testify, and then we'll have a discussion on the bill. We have on the list, and maybe we can have all of you guys come up on the table, and then we can just go down the line. So Mr. Franson, Ms. Turlow, Mr. Pearson, and Mr. Finewax? You can determine your order. Please just state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Doug Franzen. I'm an attorney for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, and today I am representing the Minnesota Council on Health Plans, the trade association for Minnesota's 8 non-for-profit health plans. Now, Madam Chair, do you want to go on the line, or should I just continue?
Please just continue.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, the Council's position on false claims is very clear. We're against false claims. Not as even a matter of good government, but we live with false claims every day. My company, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, processes over 126,000 claims each and every day. The vast majority of them are paid. Our data shows we pay them out in 8 days. We, however, have a number of wrong claims that we're faced with every day. Some of them are fraudulent, false, and we prosecute them vigorously. The vast majority of such claims are inadvertent mistakes, coding errors, some very good providers who, frankly, are not very good bookkeepers. We have to sort that through. But the essence of the fraudulent claim is such that we take it very seriously, as we believe should the state. We want to take the opportunity, as Minnesota's health plans, to thank Senator Latz. He has been very gracious with his time. We have had several very constructive dialogues on a high level, and we made a number of suggestions which we hope will be seen as constructive, which were incorporated into the Delete Everything by Senator Latz. And we do want to thank him. In fact, to our knowledge, Senator Latz took all of our suggestions, but for one, And I just would like to limit my comments to addressing that one suggestion. Our only remaining area of concern is found in Section 11 of the bill, limitation of actions remedies. Specifically, paren C, close paren, found on line 6.16 and point 617. That is a provision which provides for retroactive application of this law.
Yes, that's what I do.
We believe that this provision is not essential to the goal of this bill. We believe this provision is not important to this bill. However, it does give us grievous heartburn. Let me say that health plans, like the state, have available remedies. We prosecute fraud. We don't pay fraudulent claims. We pursue them vigorously, and sometimes we don't find them. We're similarly situated with you. So we appreciate that. However, the point I want to make is that by deleting the retroactivity, you are not leaving the state without a remedy. Existing law provides full recourse and remedy to the state. The essential difference is you're not incenting whistleblowers going way back. We don't think you should. The mother of all false claims acts is the Federal Fair Claims Act. You've probably heard about that. Senator Latz has told you about that. We are subject to it, and we have no problem with it. We work very well within the context of the federal law. However, the federal law contains no retroactivity provision. Of all the conforming states, the federal government has said, yes, you are eligible for this 10% payout. None of them, with the sole exception of the state of California, have a retroactive provision. And I think that's intuitive, because generally the law does not favor retroactive application of new enactments. There's good reasons for that. I won't go through them all. But essentially, the passage of time is not the friend of a successful prosecution or defense of any lawsuit. Credibility of witnesses is compromised. They may move away. Their memories may fade. You may see an increase in old grudges, non-meritorious claims. From our position, we believe it causes unnecessary time and expense to respond to aged claims. And I believe we have the ultimate statute of limitations is 10 years in this. Like most employers, we have people move around a lot. Key actors may go to one of our competitors, may leave the state, may no longer be available, may pass on. We have terrible problems, as does anyone in any circumstance, with aged claims in either proving your case or defending your case. We think the intrinsic lack of reliability of going back a decade to try to reconstruct does not justify the proof problems and the universal difficulties with retroactivity. Madam Chair, again, we would ask that those two lines, those two non-essential lines of the bill, be deleted. With that deletion, we would withdraw any objection to this bill whatsoever. And once I would like to conclude my comments, Madam Chair, members, by again thanking Senator Latz. We're involved in a lot of issues, and while this is a difficult and technical issue, I think I could speak for all members of the Council of Health Plans. It has been a pleasure to deal with the Senator and the Chair and the members.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Any questions for Mr. Franzen? Very good. Our next witness, please.
Madam Chair, members, my name is David Finewax. I am General Counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association. Let me say for the record, from my perspective, it has been a pleasure to deal with everyone except for Mr. Franzen.
Full
This is a technical, complicated issue, and although I am an attorney, I'm not necessarily much of an attorney in this regard. I mean, certainly I'm better than Mr. Franzen, but that's not much. We have a number of problems with this, and let me say from the outset, no one is advocating theft or fraud, and from our perspective, that's not what we're about. You know, the Walgreens situation was a case where somebody sent a memo to pharmacists saying if somebody comes in with a prescription for Prilosec, don't give them the tablets that are cheap, give them the capsules that are expensive, which is just a blatant attempt to defraud the, you know, the government. And they went after that, and that's a wonderful thing, and we salute the people who did that, and that's a good thing. Let me explain to you why we're concerned about this. We believe the federal law is sufficient. We believe it's always been sufficient. We're concerned about creating new causes of actions. We're concerned about creating new forms. We're concerned about a concept called bootstrapping, which I will explain to you in a minute. But I think perhaps the most useful thing I can do is talk to you about our everyday situations, not necessarily as an attorney, but someone who represents and understands providers.
Mr. Feinwalk, can you pull your microphone a little bit closer?
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
At the end of the day, this is about coding. This is about computers and numbers and submissions to the government and a very large volume situation for a variety of things. And when I talk about coding, I want you to consider a couple of things. One, for us, the simplest analogy I can offer is imagine your home computer, which has a spell checker, and you rely on this and this works. But what if the government changed the spelling of commonly used words on a regular basis, and it's possible that, you know, this week four is spelled F-O-U-R and next week it's spelled, you know, F-O-O-R. You might use the wrong spelling without intent, without malicious conduct, and the way these definitions are written, that would be false. Another real-world application that I want to at least ask you to consider, because I was involved in this within the last week, so that we know what is encompassed by this and what providers deal with. I was contacted by a hospital who discovered there is a category of professional called Certified Occupational Therapy Assistant. And, you know, these are wonderful people. They help folks who have strokes, you know, get better and learn how to dress themselves and so forth. They're critically important. They're great people. They're licensed in Minnesota. A provider found out that they had such a person who over the last 9 years on a very, very part-time basis had put in about 1,000 hours with them. So basically, you know, half of a year over a nine-year period. So we're talking about 3 weeks a year, you know, working part-time. They were qualified to hold a license. You know, they met all the standards. They took the test. But for reasons known only to them, they didn't send in the $50 to get the license, so they didn't have the license. This means that all the claims they made for all the cases involved where this person rendered assistance to a patient are false. Now, of course, my advice to this provider was you must immediately inform the government of this. You must tell them this has happened. You must ask them, how do you want to proceed? How do we parse this out? Can we somehow back out the value of this person's services? Do we disallow the entire claim? What do we do? The other thing that the provider immediately does is begin to look at how can this happen, which they did. And they found out that they checked to see that people have licenses on a certain month every year and that this person had, for whatever reason, scheduled their work schedule never to be around during that month, and so nobody knew, and that is a defect in their system. So basically, they said, okay, we've discovered a defect here. We have to change how we check for licensure, which they did. The person knew they didn't have a license, and they were discharged. The state was informed that this had occurred, and the federal government said, you know, how do we parse this out? How do you wish to proceed? And so my question is, given that this is the commonly way that this kind of false claim thing happens, do we really want to encourage somebody to try to go in and say, you know, every time this happens, somebody owes me $10,000 for every occurrence, plus three times whatever the amount in question is, because the Attorney General probably won't take this case because the right thing was done. So this basically gives a green light to this kind of thing, and we're very, very concerned about it. Because for us, this is about coding and this is about computers. The other thing you need to remember is that in Minnesota, we've been encouraging people to get into the computer age. 20% of all the doctors in this state don't have a computer, not even a laptop. And we're now working on changing coding systems, and we're going to require that they get computers. There's going to be mistakes. Are there going to be mistakes? Yes. Are some of them unavoidable? Yes. Do we want to punish these things when people identify them and say, hey, we made a mistake, let's work it out? No, I don't think we do. The other thing I want to talk to you about is a concept that I'm very concerned about called bootstrapping. Minnesota's kind of in a unique situation. In order to get people to participate in Medicaid and GAMC, we bundle together programs. We take Minnesota Care and the state employees and workers' compensation, and we say these things are a package. If you don't do business with Medicaid, you don't do business with these other programs. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. That's just the way it is. But what this leads to then is the potential of an argument under this bill that, if you're Target and you're giving away a $20 gift card for transferring a prescription to me, which under Medicaid is impermissible because you're buying the business and it's fraud, you know, maybe that's fraud if it's a prescription involving a workers' compensation injury or a governmental employee who saw the ad in the newspaper or got a mailing and said, gee, I'd like to have a gift card, you know, so I think I'll go. And I'm pretty certain when Target selected their brand name, that's, you know, this isn't what they had in mind and saying, you know, we're going to call ourselves Target. We think that the chance of this kind of misuse from the other end of the equation speaks to being extremely cautious. I mean, we don't see a need for this. The other thing is, in the states which have enacted this kind of law, what happens is there's typically a couple of hundred of these cases pending, between 190 and 200. And once a state enacts this law, these stacked-up cases, which typically involve national organizations, are immediately served upon the Attorney General. The Attorney General, of course, has to expend resources going through all of them, which creates a fiscal implication for the government, trying to sort them out and decide, you know, what they want to do. And they probably don't want to do anything because most of them are dealing with the kinds of things I've described. So it's not all rosy and it's not as simple as it seems. So on behalf of providers, I want to say it's a serious question to create further disincentive to participate in bundled public programs. It's a very serious thing. We try as hard as we can to train our people in coding, and we're constantly retraining in coding. But it's not such an easy thing. Anybody who's ever received a bill from a healthcare provider knows, you know, what I'm about to tell you, that the bill is unintelligible and the coding is unintelligible, and I probably owe you an apology for that, but that's the fact of life. It is unintelligible, and we're struggling with that. This puts us at risk and creates some serious policy questions, and so we have some concerns, and we're not all that fond of this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. And for our two remaining testifiers, I want to be respectful, but you are presenting some really good issues here, and I want to give members of the committee as much opportunity as possible to talk about the issues that you've brought up. So to the degree that you could help us expedite it along, that would be great. Ms. Turlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to members of the committee. I think that I can expedite testimony as well. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of Aging Services of Minnesota, but also appearing with my colleague who will testify in a moment on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Let me just first give a little bit of background that we too represent providers on the other side of the spectrum, the aging services spectrum. Aging Services of Minnesota represents a little over half of the nursing homes in the state, primarily the nonprofit nursing homes. But we also represent other providers that also engage with the state, assisted living providers, independent senior housing, home care providers. And so we have a number of members concerned with the bill. I want to start by, thanking Senator Latz for the discussion on the bill. I think we still have some concerns about this, and I want to echo much of what Mr. Feinwachs has stated, particularly with the concern of the potential impact of the inadvertent mistake that could potentially be made in billing or submitting claims. I think Mr. Feinwachs well illustrated the complexity of billing for providers in general, and those complexities apply in the aging services realm as well. One of the areas of concern that we have, or one of the areas that we would like to see some additional effort made to maybe give a little bit more comfort is to address the situation where there's an inadvertent claim, but where the providers have done everything correctly as soon as they've as soon as reasonably can address and make corrections, looking for some opportunities to demonstrate, give us some time to cure the mistake, but also then in the situation, make sure that we're not held for liable under this particular claim. I would draw your attention to one area that creates some particular concern is under Section 2 of the bill, and I'm referring to the Delete All Amendment. I believe it's Clause 7, lines 16 through 18. This is a particularly area of concern for us, where it is talking about inadvertent claims, and that after discovering the falsity of the claim, knowingly fails to disclose the falsity of the claim to the state within the reasonable time. I know that there have been some attempts to make that more palatable for providers, but simply put, we still have some concerns, in part because the knowledge aspect here, it's not clear to us when knowledge will be imputed to the employer ourselves, so that perhaps we may have an employee who figures out that they make a mistake, and that they've mistakenly submitted a claim to the state. But for whatever reason, they don't want to come forward to the employer to admit their mistake. They might be concerned about getting in trouble for making a mistake or what have you. Our concern here is that knowledge on that employee would still be imputed to the employer and that we would still be subject to potential liability under this claim. We would be more comfortable if there was some additional language given that would allow us to, when the issue is reported to an appropriate person within the employer, give us reasonable time to cure and for these, again, inadvertent mistakes. I want to make clear here that, again, to echo the theme that no one here, everyone here is interested in stamping out intentional fraud. That we want to be out there, again, you know, catching the bad guys here. But those potential, the risk for potentially inadvertent claims and the risk here for employers being on the hook without even a chance to cure is of great concern to us. The language at the bottom also gives us a little, of that same section also gives us a little bit of concern, only because it talks about where an employer cooperates, this is under Clause B, cooperates with the investigation, provides full information to the state, but still could be potentially liable for damages at a minimum two times the damages, but could be fully liable for the maximum amount. Again, in the case of an inadvertent claim where the employer finds out about it, works with the state, pays restitution, provides all the information and cooperates, we have some concerns there on that particular claim, on that particular language. So, again, we hope that we can work with the bill authors to provide a little bit of comfort here. We think that we can get there, but until that comfort is given, we have some concerns.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. As Carrie said, I'm with Care Providers, and together we're with the Long-Term Care Imperative. Not to repeat or echo what has previously been stated, another concern that we have is basically a piling on that's taking place. Providers of long-term care, of hospitals, of anything in health and human services right now are facing a lot of cuts and freezes in these economic times. A bill like this, although it's designed to go after the bad guys, ends up being overbroad. And as a result of that, we incur extra expenses just in case it were to happen. What I mean by that is it's increased costs as insurance rates and legal costs. Not that it will ever happen for sure, but because we have to anticipate if it did happen, it would cost us more money. So we do have the concerns of not being able to cure or doing the right thing and being punished for it. We're in agreement that we need to go after fraud. We're afraid that with this bill, the net is cast too broad, and it needs to be narrowed down to address the concerns that we've shared with you regarding curing inadvertent mistakes or billing errors. Thank you.
Mr. Pearson, Ms. Thurlow, Mr. Finewalks, I'm interested in your concern about this being too, casting that too overly broad. It's my understanding that this language mirrors pretty substantially, except for the changes that were made with your input to Senator Latz, the federal law. Can you point out areas where the state has maybe gone away from the federal language in being overreaching? Ms. Thurlow?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am told, and again, I am an attorney, but like Mr. Finewalks, not an expert in this area, but I'm told that the clause that I referred to, Clause 7 on page 2, lines 16 through 18 of the Delete All, is not included in the federal version of the False Claims Act. So that would be one area that we would have concern.
And then in terms of the other area that you talked about, let's see. The second piece in line 2.29, right? In clause 3. Is that in the federal law or is that different?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would have to check with others who are more well-versed with the federal law than I am on that particular point.
Ms. Pontius, do you know?
Madam Chair, members, yeah, my reading of the federal law is that is required in terms of the damage provisions. But not the Clause 7, as you mentioned. That's not in the federal law.
Okay. Madam Chair? Senator Parisol. When you say Clause 3, are we talking about the one toward the top of the page or the one below 8 down there?
On line 2.16,
okay.
So, that number 7,
yes,
which is problematic, is not a language that's in the federal law. And you go down to line, I believe, 2.29.
Okay.
That is under...
That's the 3 you're talking
yes.
about. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Members, questions for our witnesses? Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I apologize because I went up to my office to get some hot tea because it's cold in here. But is this specifically to health care claims? Or, you know, we seem to have only health care lobbyists before us today, and I would have thought this would have been broader than just health care.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, yeah, technically it's not limited to health care claims. I think just the reality is that that's the group that's most likely affected by the bill, but it applies to any false claim against the state. The federal law that provides the incentive for states to do this is for in Medicaid, related to Medicaid funding. But the federal law itself, the False Claims Act, also applies to all claims. It's just the incentive part that's Medicaid funding.
Thank you.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I'm sorry that I was late in here. I just wondered, because obviously it's Mr. Thompson was able to to do this under the authority of the federal statute, and you know what he did. In that whistleblowing, but how often would the federal government be able to step in? I mean, I assume on some highway things, contracts, or, you know, anything having to do with health care, I suspect, or Medicaid, Medicare, those things would automatically trigger the federal statute. You would qualify under there. What other kinds of things? I mean, I assume that the size of the false claim matters here. And so I'm trying to think of what it would be, maybe a contract for building a state building, or that wouldn't trigger federal, or would it? Does it have to be federal money involved in the federal offense here?
Senator Latz or Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think the federal law would be claims against the federal government. If this law were enacted, it would be any claim against the state government, which could include whether it be Medicaid portions or could be, you know, highway claims. And that's probably another big area where you'd see a lot of contracts or claims to be submitted. So,
okay. then, Madam Chair, then it's striking me, would this, I mean, Mr. Thompson would have qualified for a portion of the state's portion that apparently was collected. So it wouldn't be a gain for the state. I mean, I applaud what he did. I'm not trying to, you know, demean or put that down. But, and I'm guessing that probably the medical place is where, the healthcare stuff is where you'd probably find most of this. Am I right that the state would have received less? Maybe Senator Latz would comment on that. If we had had a state statute, Mr. Thompson would have gotten a share of that as well. Am I right?
Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, that is correct. You got a couple questions in there that you asked, and Ms. Pontius answered the first question, that this is much broader than just federal law claims. So the federal government, sometimes they decide not to pursue something because it's too small a claim to be worth their time, and they, in the state would have the opportunity then to pursue a smaller claim on its own if it decided to do so, or claims that are only involve payments or false billings, for example, to the state. Or to political subdivisions. So schools, for example, if they were in a construction project or something like that, would be able to use the state law as well. Your second question, there are two pieces to it. One is the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 included this incentive for states to pass state false claims acts. The incentive is an increase of 10% in the share of the recovery for the state under Medicaid fraud settlements. So where now Minnesota gets 50% of the settlement because we pay 50%, our share of the Medicaid program is 50%, just having this act on the books would entitle us to 60% of any nationwide or national settlement or federal settlement involving Medicaid fraud. Now, that would be an increase in 10%. The corollary to that would be, yes, the portion of the state's recovery because the claim would include a Minnesota state law claim, would also be used to calculate the recovery for the whistleblower. So their percentage, which nationwide averages 17 or 18% of the value of the settlement, would be calculated, including the amount that the state recovered and not just the amount that the federal government recovered. And so you would have to calculate its projection is what we're doing here and trying to balance, you know, what in the end would be the best financially for the state. It might turn out to be a wash when you get your increased percentage, but then you share more of it with the whistleblower in the nationwide Medicaid fraud claims. But when you add into that the claims that would not otherwise be brought or pursued under either federal or state law, I would suggest that there will be more recovery. And the states that have been aggressive in pursuing their state law aspects of claims have seen a lot of recovery. Texas has recovered $100 million since they enacted their State False Claims Act. Illinois, $40 million. So there's a lot of potential here for the state.
Well, and as somebody who is concerned about that, though, that even if we don't recover that much, I mean, isn't that where we want to go, is that we are proven wrong because our people are such good actors that we don't recover that much, right, Senator Latz?
That's right.
Mr. Feinwachs?
Madam Chair. Senator Scheid, I agree completely that the act applies to any variety of transactions, but healthcare has particularly been a target because of volume and complexity relative to the way it submits billings and requests for payments and the coding issues, you know, that we discussed. Again, I want to emphasize that when you're a provider, you know, winning is one thing, but these are not simple things when somebody comes at you. These require very, very specialized attorneys. They are very, very expensive to defend. And thus far, you know, the federal law has done a magnificent job. I think part of the incentive that the feds want to create is they want somebody else to sort of, you know, get into this business because, you know, in recent years, at least around here, there hasn't been a lot of activity because I think that we are all trying to – to do it right. You know, certainly the people I represent are doing everything they can, and that's where the fear comes from. You know, we view ourselves as very likely recipients of attention here because of the complexity and volume of these cases.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, what's the floor on federal cases in order to get venue in there? Is that $100,000 or $150,000 or something on that nature?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, federal jurisdiction would obtain as long as there's a federal dollar involved. There isn't a floor for jurisdiction in the courts. As a practical matter, there may be a floor under which the federal government will simply decide it's not worth their expenditure of resources to investigate or pursue. They do that with civil fraud matters and with enforcement actions and drug crimes and all sorts of things. The U.S. Attorney's Office will say we just aren't going to pursue cases that don't reach a certain threshold because we don't have the resources to do that. We're just going to go after the big fish. It would leave an opportunity for the states to decide, well, it may be small on the federal scale, but for the state of Minnesota, it's still worth pursuing. The other related piece is that the involvement of the state, because this would be a state law claim, it would give us a seat at the table in terms of investigating and determining whether and how to settle the case. And I will give you an example. Because there are enough states now that have state false claims laws, even under the Medicaid area, there's a national organization, how do you pronounce it, NAMFUCO, Medicaid Fraud Organization, that's really a coalition of state organizations that will help investigate these things. Now, when the feds looked at a particular case and they valued it at $250 million, when the NAMFUCO staff and attorneys took a look at it on behalf of the states that had a piece of the action, if you will, skin in the game, they valued it differently. They ended up with a settlement of $650 million. So just the involvement of the states and a variety of viewpoints and inputs in that had a dramatic impact on how that case got resolved.
Madam Chair,
Senator Foley.
On that, in the case of Mr. Thompson, he's filing an action in federal court, and there is a floor there. I don't know what the amount is, but counsel could put that in. So at some point, he would not be eligible to file a claim.
Madam Chair. Senator Scheid and then Senator Olson.
Okay,
on this point.
Madam Chair. Oh.
No. Is it on this point,
well,
Senator Scheid?
Well, it has to do with whether or not somebody is going to prosecute this case. And
Senator Scheid.
About, if I could, Madam Chair and Senator Latz, the Attorney General would probably be the route for this to go. But, I mean, I think the first thing you do is see if the Attorney General wants to participate here or intervene. And I see that there's a place for them to not, you know, to choose not to. I'm just wondering, and I missed the beginning, so I'm embarrassed and apologize if you already said, but is the Attorney General on board with this piece of this, and are they adequately staffed to do it, or does it not even involve anything more? They already have people there to help with the federal statute.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I've had some conversations with the Attorney General's office, and I believe there is or will be a fiscal note that accompanies this relating to staffing if this were to pass. At this point, they have taken no position on the bill itself. Madam Chair, if I might, with regard to Senator Foley's question, there is a dollar threshold when diversity jurisdiction is invoked in federal court. Not only do you have to be from different states, but there's a dollar threshold, is my understanding, before the federal court will take on diversity jurisdiction. But when it's a federal question, when it's federal statute that's involved, it doesn't matter what the dollar amount is. Jurisdiction rests with the federal court. And, in fact, the Federal False Claims Act would require whenever there's a federal claim of fraud involving the federal government, it has to go to federal court. It could not proceed in state court, even if it's got pendent state law claims.
Mr. Feinwalks, but is that what you were trying to?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, going to the question of the dollar amount, I agree with Senator Latz. I do not believe there is any dollar amount as a threshold. But again, I ask you to consider that the way this is written, if I overbill you using a computer a nickel for an item, and I do it 1,000 times with a computer, that's a 5-minute process. I owe you 1,000 nickels. I also owe you 1,000 times 15 cents plus $11,000 for every time that happened. That's a pretty big brass ring. That's what attracts key TAM lawyers and plaintiffs to these kinds of things, even when they're discovered and corrected.
But, Mr. Feinwalks, I know that you are concerned about frivolous activities in this area. But from your description, it seems that the standard of preponderance and the knowing and knowingly acting language with actual knowledge, deliberate ignorance of the truth, acts in a reckless disregard of the truth, these proof standards seems to me to be pretty specific. That and then the language about inadvertent action, it seems to me that the safeguard is in here. And I appreciate your concern. I understand about the coding and the complexity, but I'm not persuaded that it is that easy or that indefensible from your industry's perspective.
Actually, Madam Chair, members, those terms are, from our perspective, ambiguous. They don't provide any particular great comfort. If a new forum is going to be created at the state level for these litigations, it remains to be seen what they mean. At the federal level in the early years, we spent some time litigating to get some clarity and parameters, and we would be starting that process again. But although they sound good, I assure you they're not that good. If one of my employees who programmed the computer knew, that's actual knowledge. They put in that code. They intended to put in 612 instead of 611. They did it, and there's no denying it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz and then Senator Olson has been holding up, wanting to speak.
2 points in response to that. One is the definition of knowing and knowingly in this proposed bill is identical to the federal law. Identical down to the periods. I mean, there is no new standard here. Whatever federal litigation there was on that standard, I'm sure would be the guidepost. Secondly, with regard to inadvertence or mistake, that has also been sorted out in the federal process. But there is even a provision that we added in response to input from some of the parties of interest that would provide for a shift for attorney's fees to be awarded against the whistleblower if they bring a frivolous, knowing, intentionally frivolous claim. So it's even stronger than Rule 11 in Section 549.211. With regard to attorney's fees and sanctions and claims for
where is that section, Senator Latz?
That is, I believe it's on the last page of the bill, Madam Chair.
Line 626 through to the end of that section, I believe, members, for your reference. All right, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Latz, and you've already addressed a part of what I was going to ask or say because that was my comments were directed toward that subdivision 7, and I was also having a hard time understanding how, as much as I can certainly sympathize with the complexities and wish we didn't have all the complications in different ways of submitting bills that today, it seems to me like subdivision 7 protects you when there's been a disclosure of the falsity. And that seems contrary to what you were saying, is that even if you disclose the falsity, you're still going to be able to get nailed under this subdivision. It seems like there's a protection as long as you come forward and bring the information to someone's attention. And so I was having a hard time understanding the flow of what you were saying and how that would fit with this language. So then my question, Senator Latz, is do you know whether there are any other states or anywhere else that has this implemented language similar to Subdivision 7? And if they have, if that kind of thing has been a problem for administrations where they've been held responsible for something that was inadvertent and that they wanted to correct but somehow couldn't?
Senator Olson, are you referring to Clause 7 of line 2.16?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I know it's not in the federal law. I'm not aware that it is in any other state law either, but I don't have the specific knowledge to say that for sure.
Senator Latz, just refresh us. This is part of the language that was given to you from some of the advocates?
The insertion of knowingly on line 2.17 was our response to the concern that was raised by them. To make sure that we were not creating a strict liability provision here, that it had to have been a failure to disclose it, a knowing failure to disclose it once they found out. So if they find out there's a billing code error and they go to the government and say, oops, we got a problem here, that protects them from the liability. If, however, they don't do that within a reasonable period of time, then they are engaged in the cover-up and should be held liable accordingly.
Ms. Thurlow?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, if I can speak briefly to that issue as well. And I do appreciate, again, Senator Latz trying to work with us regarding the concern here. The concern still remains, though, is the question on knowingly fails to disclose. The question is whose knowledge and at what point, again, there's the case of the employee who finds out about the mistake and then continues to cover it up without telling his or her supervisor because they don't want to get in trouble. That knowledge could be imputed to the employer, in our cases, some of our member nursing homes, and we could still be potentially liable under this. So we would like to tighten that language up, or because it's not required by the feds, would probably be more comfortable taking that out, but also including a provision to allow for an employer the right to cure in the case of inadvertent mistakes and give us time to reimburse the state if there's an inadvertent mistake and take proper corrective action.
Senator Latz.
I've consulted with my experts on this. Common law with regard to imputing knowledge of individual employees to an organization is what's been applied in the Federal False Claims Act, you know, for 100 years when President Lincoln first proposed the False Claims Act on a federal level, and it would apply in this case too. So a low-level employee who does the miscoding and doesn't tell anyone about it, that is not going to impute the whole organization's knowledge. Typically, when you get into levels of management that become aware and don't do anything about it, then you start imputing organizational knowledge. But common law would apply in that situation.
Yeah. Members, I understand that while it is my time constraint, I understand that some of these individuals might want to also go to another hearing in the other body because this is being taken up in about 5 minutes or the other committee will be starting. I am wondering if we could have a discussion about one issue, and then I will take the pulse to see if we're ready to act on this or if we should lay it over, maybe give these individuals an opportunity to look at some of these areas. But let's come back to that. I'd like for us to focus a little bit on the retroactivity date that Mr. Franson brought up. There's a reference in there to subdivision A above, which I believe imposes a 10-year retroactive statute of limitation, some kind of limitation. Is that correct, Mr. Franson?
Madam Chair, I believe so. As I understand subdivision A, there's really three tests. The 3 years after discovery by the Attorney General or 6 years after the occurrence, but in no event later than 10 years. Frankly, I don't have complete knowledge of what that 10 years means, but my operating assumption is that with that language included, that is the duration of the potential retroactive application.
Okay. Senator Latz, is that an accurate interpretation, or could you share with us what your thinking is on this?
That's my understanding, Madam Chair, as well. And the idea there was that we not give a free pass to those who've engaged in this conduct over the last 10 years, illegal conduct, just because there hasn't been a particular statute that gave them an incentive to come forward.
And Senator Latz, is this federal? Is this federal language?
Madam Chair, no. The statute of limitations in the federal law, I believe, is 10 years. But that law has been around for a long time. So the issue of retroactivity, I don't think, is even in the federal law.
So the retroactivity issue is unique to Minnesota?
Madam Chair, correction.
Mr. Franzen?
None of the states that have passed conforming action, with the exception of California, which I never like to follow, have any retroactive provisions.
Madam Chair, in some other areas, we've gotten into trouble sometimes when we've had retroactive dates and try to have tie into discovery of when it was and so forth, and invariably we come back and have to fix it and change it because it's always problematic when you try to go backwards. Prospective, that's not a problem, but going retroactive with an effective date does create some issues.
Yes, Senator Latz, I do have some concerns that this might create some potential constitutionality issues, but let's hear Senator Olson, and then Senator Parasol. I know you've had your hands up. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know about the constitutionality. I guess whatever, I'd be interested in what counsel had to say about that. It's not exactly creating a criminal penalty, where you'd so I think there might be a distinction there. But I guess I'm just wondering whether some of the issues about retroactivity that were raised by Mr. Feinwachs and others would be any different than if we were 10 years in the future looking at this and we have to go back 10 years. And, you have those same issues no matter what. And so I can kind of identify with Senator Latz's comment that it's giving a free pass to people. If this is the right thing to do, why shouldn't, as long as we don't have those constitutional concerns, I would be inclined to go along with it.
When was the Federal Act passed, Senator Latz?
1863.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't take us back all the way to then. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to ask the people at the table who have a knowledge of this, or especially Senator Latz, probably, how does this particular content of the bill translate into other fields and industries? I mean, I understand it was triggered here by the Medicaid issues, but you have all things from construction all the way on up that government is involved in, the same as they are in medicine or healthcare. So how far can this be constructed for all those other fields and industries, and what's the field of interest of this, I guess? How broad is it?
Whoever is going to respond, can you pull the mic
anybody
closer
and everybody
to your phone, to your mouth, and try to project into it? Mr. Franzen?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Parasol, it's my understanding and belief that this act would apply to all government contracting, all interactions with the state. It is not limited to health care and Medicare. To repeat what Mr. Feinwachs, I almost called him Senator Feinwachs, and that would be a terrible thing. What Mr. Feinwachs said is probably the emphasis on health care issue is just because of the volume of claims that are submitted to the state by health care providers and plans as government contractors. If I may, Madam Chair, one point again on the retroactivity. There is no free pass looking backwards. Fraud is a crime, and it has been throughout these other endeavors. When Senator Parasol mentioned construction, I remember a number of years ago a bid rigging scandal, and the state successfully, and I believe the federal government as well, successfully prosecuted. Fraud is illegal. There is no free pass. The key distinction is the dollar penalties, which are a deterrent, not a look back, but are deterring bad behavior and incentivizing whistleblowers. Those are the key new features on this. This does not make fraud illegal. It always has been, and may be prosecuted as
such.
Thank
you for clearing that up, because, you know, it's transferable into printing and everything you can think of practically.
Madam Chair, if I may follow up on that for 30 seconds.
Senator Latz.
Or less. Fraud requires proof of intent to defraud. It's their goal is to defraud. This civil statute would not require that proof, which is an extraordinarily high standard. But if they knew about it and they continued to do it, that would capture this area. And these are state tax dollars that we're talking about that these companies shouldn't be getting, whether it's in the construction industry or any other case where a state tax dollar is involved. Let me add one other point on the retroactivity part of it. If we leave the retroactivity in, then it ensures that the state will have a seat at the table for all existing cases that are pending right now. There are at least 190 Medicaid fraud cases that are pending right now around through the U.S. Attorney's Office. So there is an advantage to that.
Members, there are obviously, this has been a great amount of work that has been done. My compliments to you, Senator Latz, and all the different advocates for working very hard. I think that there's still some issues that are outstanding. I have complete confidence that the cordial working relationship that has been established here may be able to resolve that. Members, we have a couple of choices here. We could lay this over and have all these good people come back next week, or this bill is going on, and you know that I'm not one to punt when it is our opportunity to help make the bills better. But this bill is going on to the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee, which is another policy committee. That will consider this, and then I believe it will be forwarded on to the Finance Committee. And I think that we've done a fairly good amount of work. I will leave it to the will of this committee to determine whether, you know, you would like these good people to come back with an attempt to continue to work on this, or if we feel that we for the discussion that we've had, we could forward it on with the expectation that they might continue to work on it. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, apparently it is true that this bill is going to be heard over the House shortly. And some
yes.
Of people, okay, so,
and they have
so
to
I think we do need to get them on their way. You know, I guess I'm the only member of this committee that actually serves on the State and Local Government Operations Committee. So that committee usually only focuses only on the issues within their jurisdiction, not on any other ones. So I think it'd be prudent to keep it here. You know, we don't need to redo all the testimony and so forth,
right.
But I think that we ought to do our Judiciary Committee work here before we move the bill on.
And I agree, Senator Betzel. That's been the practice of our committee, too. I think that on that recommendation, why don't, Senator Latz, we will lay the bill over. We will bring you back first thing in the agenda on Tuesday. And in the meantime, the couple of issue areas that you've identified, I hope that you all continue to work on that. We would have an interest in continuing the discussion on that. Thank you all very much.
Yay.
Members?
Good job.
You know, I was in D.C. about...
We're not. We're laying. There's no motion. We are adjourned.
No, she had just gotten elected.